I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Right now, the biggest elections in the world are taking place. They are unfolding slowly on the South Asian subcontinent. Nearly 1 billion people are eligible to vote in the Indian election. These have been described as the biggest democratic elections in the world. But this one in particular is somewhat shrouded in controversy. Concerns have been raised over the quality of democracy and religious tensions potentially being stoked by politicians. Dr. Mohan Dutta is a professor at Massey University's Business School and also the director of the Centre for Culture-Centred Approach to Research and Evaluation. And Mohan Dutta joins us on the line now. Kia ora to you.
Kia ora, ma'am.
It's nice to have you here. Let's talk first of all about the size and scope of these elections, because it's fair to say they're truly enormous, aren't they?
Yes, they really are. And that actually plays out in terms of the different phases of the elections that take place. And that gives you just a sense of the scope of the elections.
Would we in New Zealand, with mixed member proportional voting, would we recognise the parliamentary system that is used in India?
You would, in the sense that you would think of this as a system that has multiple political parties, and political parties often form coalitions that then go on to govern, which is in many ways an opening for a system that truly creates the space for plural democratic assertions, you know, with multiple viewpoints represented through the political system.
Let's turn to the main contenders and narratives around this year's election, if you could. There are two main political parties, aren't there? Although one has formed something of a bloc, the BJP, which is led by the Prime Minister Narendra Modi, and the INC, which has historically ruled for most of the post-independence period. Tell us a bit about these parties and how I suppose the election is poised.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a pretty accurate reflection in terms of the two main political parties, the BJP and the Congress. Now, the Congress comes out of the anti-colonial movement and therefore comes with that history. And really, if you think about the constitutional framework of India and the governing structure developed therein, the Congress had a large role to play in that sense, you know, with the first Prime Minister of India representing Congress, and Congress inherits that legacy then in terms of India's constitutional commitments to a secular democratic republic. The BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, one would say is the political arm of Hindutva, which is a far-right nationalist ideology, and really comes into formation in the 1980s amidst the rise of Hindutva as a cultural political force, and then consolidates itself around the construction of Muslims as a threat to the nation and the assertion of Hindu nationalist identity. So in that sense, BJP is a political party that is very much rooted in Hindutva politics.
And is that a complicating factor? Because as you mentioned earlier, India nominally is a secular country, and yet overwhelmingly the population is Hindu, correct?
Yes, yes. And that is, one would argue that the beauty of India, in the sense that, you know, if you really think about the social science around Indian democracy, it is seen as quite a miracle because, you know, most of the literature suggests that for a democracy to flourish, you need the economic infrastructure to be flourishing. And here you had a country emerging out of the anti-colonial movement and really developing habits of democracy that have been plural and that have been fundamentally embedded in this idea of secularism, that all faiths are equally represented in terms of the rights of practitioners of the faith, and at the same time have an opportunity to assert these rights through the various justice structures of the constitutional framework, if you will.
Now, these elections have long, well, India's election has long been described as the biggest democratic election in the world. And yet, I see various think tanks and international commentators, and indeed, I think the Economist's Global Democracy Index saying that that descriptor, democratic, is a bit could be interpreted as being a bit misleading these days. Why is that? What is the thinking behind that?
Yes, so what's been quite striking, and this connects with BJP being the political arm of Hindutva, which is that if you think of Hindutva as a far right ideology, it is constituted around constructing India as a Hindu nation, and it really derives much of its thinking from Nazi ideas around constructing a nation based upon notions of cultural nationalism, if you will. So what you're seeing play out in that sense is a form of what the V-Dem Institute describes as an electoral autocracy, which means that India still holds regular elections, but its government is increasingly autocratic, and also that there aren't really sufficient safeguards in place to ensure free and fair elections. And this is really a critical component when thinking about the elections.
I'll just ask, when you referred to Nazi ideals there, would you mind elaborating on that a bit?
Yes, so if you think about some of the founders of the Hindutva ideology, Goldwalkar, Savarkar, they explicitly referred to texts from Nazi Germany and ideas from that context to talk about India being a Hindu nation and needing to be governed as a Hindu nation based upon ideas of racial purity. Of course, there is a conflation there because race is constructed in terms of religion, and religion being Hinduism seen as religion of the land. That's why India is a Hindu nation or Hindu Rashtra.
Okay, yeah, because some people I imagine would find even in context a descriptor like that or a comparison like that to be a bit offensive, but you feel as though it's a more specific context that you're talking about it there?
Absolutely. And it is also evidenced empirically then in the formal texts that form the core of the Hindutva ideology. So, if you were to actually go back and look at what these texts are saying, what these authors are saying, that's pretty clearly spelled out in terms of those references to Nazi Germany, ideas from there, and the notion of India as a Hindu nation.
All right, I thank you for that context. Now, look, let's talk a bit about Narendra Modi, who has been the Prime Minister of India for, I think, 10 years now, enjoys, I think, one of the highest approval ratings of any national leader in the world. A poll in February 2024 is saying 78% approval rating in India. This is absolutely staggering. These are numbers that any world leader would think would be unthinkable, I imagine. What is behind this tremendous popularity of this leader, or is that figure perhaps slightly misleading itself?
So there are two parts to it. One is sort of the appeal of Hindutva in the contemporary context of India. So if you think about the post-colonial history of India, Hindutva offers a sense of identity, if you will, for many Indians in terms of asserting the Indianness in a global context. And that often is an underlying feature, if you will, of the sort of the strong arm kind of politics that is reflected by Narendra Modi. So in Narendra Modi, then you have this strong man that is bringing India back its lost glory. This is the moment for India to emerge on the global arena as a leader. And it really is, and it is, this is practically framed in this way in sort of the broader popular context of Hindutva, which is that it is really Hindu Renaissance or the revival of Hinduism, a decolonizing moment, if you will. So that's sort of one context. The other context of this is that simultaneously what you have seen is the systemic targeting harassment of opposition politicians, ongoing attacks on media houses and journalists, including journalists being incarcerated. If you look at the Press Freedom Index of India since 2018, it's at 160, 161, around that figure, among 181 countries. It's pretty low. So that gives you another part of the picture, that this rising popularity is set in the backdrop of the ongoing targeting of dissenting voices of journalists and opposition politicians.
Right, and perhaps that contributes to that some of those narratives around flawed democracy that we discussed earlier.
Yes.
I mean, this is a
yeah.
fascinating area, isn't it? You know, India is the most populous country in the world now. It overtook China, I think, last year. And, I mean, you know, if we look at a country like China, which, for all of the many criticisms that can be levelled against it, has taken astonishing economic strides over the past 20 years or so, you know. And plenty of commentators feel that China's economic strides, perhaps this is reductive, but could at least partly be put down to a kind of social contract between the government and the people. You know, you accept restraints to some of your liberties and freedoms, and in exchange we promise you steady growth and a better quality of life. And you know, whatever you think, China has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty over the past couple of decades. Is there a sense that perhaps a similar mode of governance could benefit, perhaps has benefited India?
You know, this is a fascinating question. So if you really look at some of the fundamental economic metrics, particularly in terms of Human Development Index and inequality in India, what you in fact see is that the scale of inequality has continued to grow. You also see at the same time tremendous consolidation of power in the hands of few corporate interests, if you will. So in that sense, you know, even with economic opportunities, really the question worth asking is, how are these economic opportunities being distributed, and who is gaining from these economic opportunities? The other part of the puzzle, though, and this is sort of the post-colonial context of India that differs significantly from the historical context of China, if you will, which is that India is positioned globally as a democracy. And in that sense, truly, as a reflection of fairly powerful example of grassroots community democracy, where even amongst the poorest, you have seen significant political participation in democratic processes. And one could argue that you cannot really have development in that sense without democracy. At least that has been the Indian story. So when you have fundamental institutions being weakened in this sense, you know, all the way from the justice system to the election commission, when you have journalists and the press being targeted, when you have opposition politicians being incarcerated, and then in that backdrop, you see the rise of hate speech, you see the rise of Islamophobia in India, it really puts forth a very concerning picture, particularly in terms of the kind of balance we might be looking for in Asia in terms of international relations.
The final question. The elections, I think, finish on the 1st of June. And India, I mean, just, as you alluded to there, it's really in a unique position in the world, isn't it? There's the biggest population, a very young population, a rapidly growing middle class, a rapidly growing economy, increasing investment from the government, government spending. But there are big problems as well. Youth unemployment is very high. There are tensions geopolitically with Pakistan and China. This election is big, not just for India and not just for that part of the world, but for the world as a whole, right? Like, India is kind of the belle of the ball when it comes to trade agreements and securing a free trade agreement. I think it's one of Christopher Luxon's number one priorities. This is a hugely consequential election for the world, because this is a potential great power really sort of, you know, putting its pants on.
Absolutely. And that is where, you know, the argument I will put forth is that the human rights conditions in India, the experiences of oppressed caste communities, Dalits, Muslims, Christians in India, these are not just questions that are internal to India precisely for that reason, but these are questions that are going to play out in the global landscape, if you will. Which is why I think in terms of our foreign policy, it is really important when we think about engaging India that we also consider how we engage questions of religious freedom, how we engage questions of human rights, how we engage questions of democracy, press freedom, and overall indices of freedom of expression.
It'll be fascinating to see what happens both in the short term and the long term. Professor Mohan Dutta, thanks so much for your time this evening. Really interesting stuff.
Thank you for having me.
That's Mohan Dutta. Mohan is the director of the Centre for Culture-Centred Approach to Research and Evaluation at Massey University.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.